weird, time-sensitive, or just not long enough for a full episode, this is bonus content.
All right, everyone. I've done a bunch of different bonus content, a bunch of different interviews. I've even interviewed other game designers, but this is a first because I was actually able to come and travel to talk to our current guest. And I was super happy to find that he's actually like around the street from my work. In fact, he was so around the corner that I showed up insanely early. Jeff Engelstein has put out a ton of some of my favorite games and has been in the industry for a long time. I've often heard two things. One, he is the smartest man in gaming. I've heard that from many different people. And having just listened to the most recent Ludology podcast, which he does, I would agree with that. I've also heard he's one of the nicest men in gaming. And the fact that when I showed up an hour and a half early, he didn't say, please come back. What the heck are you doing here? He said, come have dinner with my family. So, Jeff Engelstein, thank you so much for being a part of this.
Oh, well, I appreciate you inviting me onto the show. And yeah, I was glad to learn that we live so close together. So that's kind of neat.
Yeah. So just...
Although I don't know, I would say I certainly know many people smarter than me in gaming, and certainly many people nicer than me in gaming. So I reject your setup right off the bat, but that's okay.
I will say that at bare minimum, because there have been many episodes of Ludology where I'm just like, what are they talking about? But I still listen because I feel smarter from the experience.
Okay, well, I appreciate that.
So yeah, at bare minimum, you're a lot smarter than me. Let's just start off with you personally for whatever. Tell you a little bit about yourself and who you are.
Sure. So, I've played games my whole life. Started out, initially with just regular family games and stuff like that, and then got into, D&D, and in the 70s got into, more serious like war games and mm-hmm. stuff like that. And really just kind of kept playing all, my whole life. Had always messed around a little bit with design, mm-hmm. but hadn't really done it formally. But then I started getting more involved in the industry. The first kind of steps towards that was I spoke with Tom Vassell almost 10 years ago now and offered to do a segment on his mm-hmm. show, The Dice Tower, about technology and science and games and math and the way that all
which
comes
was
together.
The first time I heard your voice
right.
was on the
so
Dice
so that
Tower.
Became the Game Tech segment, which started just about 10 years ago. And before that, I had knew Tom. He was living in Korea, and I would do business in Korea. So whenever I was over there, we would connect and play some games and stuff. So that was always fun. And so just from doing that, I started meeting a lot of people. Ended up, as you mentioned, the Ludology podcast started about 5 years ago. And that I took that same idea and worked with Ryan Sturm as my co-host, and we talk for about an hour about game design topics. So from all that and the involvement in the industry, I decided to kind of try my hand at game design. So right around the time when we started Ludology, I also published my first game with my son called The Ares Project. Mm-hmm. And, since then, I've probably got about 10 or 11 games out on the market now. So we've done a lot of them. I actually have two more coming out this year, which I'm excited about, which maybe we'll get to talk about a little bit later. But it's been, mm-hmm. it's been such a great industry to be a part of. The people have just been so nice and so friendly, and I enjoy being able to return that courtesy to people.
Yeah, that's one thing that straight off the bat was just something that I loved was that I remember the first time I went to Gen Con, and I found myself just going, you know what, I'm never going to get to actually talk to these people. These people are like legends. Especially when you're talking about the old school, like, D&D grognards. I'm like, there's no way that, like, Frank Mensah is going to talk to me. And everybody is just, if they're not doing anything and they don't have anything on their schedule, everybody is just so willing to talk and to hang out. And to, I spent so much time just literally, like, having dinner with people is the craziest thing.
Yeah, and I from the Ludology show, which, not many people really know about. I mean, we get a decent listener base, but it's not, the top of the pack. But, we would just contact, like, Peter Alaka, who designed Cosmic Encounter. I just mm-hmm. sent him an email. I was like, hey, we'd love to have you on our show. And he was there. Or Martin mm-hmm. Wallace, or, all these guys that were, again, just kind of heroes. That you just reach out to them, and everyone is very happy to come on and very happy to talk. We even had like Richard Garfield, Design Magic the Gathering was on the show and stuff like that. So it's people have been really nice. And I as we record this, we're sitting here in my basement, the mm-hmm. the gaming sanctum. And, You know, we have a I have a big game party here at my house, usually once or twice a year. And at one point, we were like over 100 people, but that got a little bit crazy. So we tried to trim it back a little bit, yeah. But now we're like 50 to 70. But, you know, I have many, many people coming that are just, I find out they're in the area or something, or they just send me an email and say, hey, I'm in the area. I'd love to come by. And, you know, I just add them to the list. And I've had people say to me, it's like, you have all these strangers coming over to your house and aren't you worried that they're going to steal something or mess something up or whatever? And I'm like, you know, look, I've never had a problem.
Yeah.
And, you know, to this day, we've been doing it for years and years and years. I've never had an issue with the, you know, any of these parties or just, you know, like I talked about when I was in Korea meeting Tom Vassell, when I go on a lot of business trips, I'll say, hey, I'm going to Akron. Is anybody in Akron that wants to meet? And so far, I have not been axe murdered. So, so you know, it's worked out really well.
But yeah, I mean, I think all of us have just a bunch of stories about how, like, so much of what we end up doing is driven by community. It's we're trying to help people build that community. We're trying to get that because of the fact that gaming is such a natural place for that. Because, you know, I've often been quoted as saying, give me 20 minutes and some cardboard and I can give you a table full of friends out of strangers. So one thing that often gets asked to me and crazy is that every time when I say, oh, I do gaming, I'm always doing this and that and everything, everyone says, well, have you ever thought about designing a game?
Yeah.
And the first response I always give is not even kind of, because I have become very much aware of all of the other stuff that comes into gaming. Everyone's like, oh, you just get together and you come up with an idea and you make it happen. And I'm like, you clearly have never spoken to a designer because there's so much other stuff that goes into it. Just because the fact that a lot of people just don't realize what's going on. Obviously, you can't say everything because I'm sure every game is a different experience. But what's just some of the things that you do when you're approaching a game design?
Well, first off, you're in a minority because almost everybody I talk to like has a game that they want to do, you know. And
I am painfully aware at the bare minimum. At the bare minimum, I know how much math and probability is involved, and that is I am rubbish at that stuff. So I am very well aware.
Well, I feel like everybody's, you know, just like everybody's got a novel in them that they mm-hmm. want to write. You know, I feel like everybody's got a game that they want to that they want to design. But it's a lot of work, and the thing about it is that the initial part, that initial idea and rush of ideas and stuff like that, that's really fun and exciting and stuff like that when you try to get it, is, you know, that's like 20% of the mm-hmm. project, right? Then you've got, there's a really long tail of stuff that you've got to do in design, even before you even go to a publisher, just in terms of, you know, fine-tuning it and just, you know, you end up in dead ends and making it have different paths to victory and different strategies people can do and make it replayable. And, you know, there's just so many elements that go into it that, yeah, it takes a lot of time and attention, and you're going to have to play that game, you know, 100 times in some form or another.
Well beyond your desire to play that
game. Right. So you really need to make sure you're designing a game that you want to play, because you're going to have to play it a lot. And if you don't like to play it, it's just going to languish. And, you know, that's usually a sign that it's not the right project for you. But it's a lot of work. And I teach, I teach a class at NYU, in their NYU Game Center for their graduate school on board game design. And it's a little frustrating to a certain extent because it's a one semester class. Mm-hmm. So whatever that is, like, you know, 14 weeks. And, they have to do three projects. I used to just be two. Now I went to three, during the course of the year. So their final project, which actually, next week is they're all due. So that's exciting for them. but they have like, you know, five weeks to work on it. Right. And so I tell them, like, look, you know, a real life game design, you know, that first 5 weeks, you know, that's just this part of it.
Right.
They don't get to see, I haven't figured out a way yet, really, other than just showing them the stuff I've done and how it's evolved, but they don't get to see the iteration and the evolution that is such a critical part of, you know, of testing it and changing it and testing it and changing it and testing it and changing it because of the time constraints. So.
Well, that's something that I, just from talking to designers, something I've picked up is when you see the first design of the game, and you see the final design, there have been times that I've seen this process and been like, how did we even get from here to here. Like, there are times when the entire theme changes. Mm-hmm. Mechanics are completely thrown out the window.
Yeah, yeah, you got to be able to ruthlessly cut. But, you know, and that happens. And sometimes, like, one of my recent games that I came out with, The Fog of War, which is a two-player war game about World War II, you know, that took me literally from when we made the first, forgetting even about the first concept, but from when we made the first prototype, took 12 or 13 years until it was published, right? And then I've got other games like Space Cadets Dice Duel, as an example, which, like, emerged fully formed into my brain. You know, it just, like, came to me in, like, a vision, and there was a little bit of tweaking. You know, it still took a couple of months of work to get it going, but, you know, that one was, like, you know, 4 months. And if you look at the first version of that versus the final version of that, it's it's very, very, very close. There's very little that actually changed between there. So, you know, you never know. It's it can be all over the place. But yeah, I mean, the shortest it's probably going to be is like 3 or 4 months for sure.
Yeah, and that's on the short end of things.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You also, now that we're talking about the design process, you also have a unique thing that not a lot of other designers do, because at least a number of your titles you've actually designed with your kids.
Mm-hmm.
And so what, I mean, obviously anytime you do anything with your kids, that's going to change the dynamic than when you're doing with somebody else. But like, how's it been? Cause you've done a couple different games, different styles and stuff like that with your kids.
Yep.
So like, how does that work? How does that change the dynamic?
Well, first off, I like collaborating. I like working with other people. You know, I've had, you know, I've just had a couple of games, you know, Expanse, which is coming out now, and Pit Crew, which sort of were solo designs, but mostly I've worked with collaborators, some of my kids and some other people. So I think it's really great to have other ideas coming into it and factoring into it. And, you know, like, my kids were older. I mean, it wasn't like working with like a 7-year-old or something like that. I mean, when we did the Ares project with my son, he was, well, it was, you know, 2011. So he was like 15 at the time when it came out. And then I did some games with my daughter, who was also around the same age when I did games with her. And we did games, all three of us, all together. My wife has stayed out of it. And during the long car rides, when we were just debating different game things and stuff like that, she would just try to tune it out and listen to the radio or whatever. But it's, so I like having collaborators. The kids come at it from a totally different perspective. You know, they're more interested in, you know, fun and excitement and what cool stuff can we do. I tend to be more analytical and, okay, yeah, we want to have a giant robot that you can do. So how are we going to fit the giant robot into the framework of what we've got? And usually we were able to figure it out. You know, sometimes we got to say, okay, we can't have that. That's just too crazy. But, you know, but it's good. And so, you know, I think the process in general worked pretty smoothly. We didn't have any major conflicts over stuff, or, you know, there was a few disagreements here or there. And every once in a while, if I absolutely had to, I would pull rank and say, okay, this is the way we're going to do it. But even in some of those cases, later on, testing would reveal that, you know, the kids were right, or I was right, or whatever. Usually, if we had an issue, we could just sit down and try it. It was also really good to do with the three of us, because you have built-in playtesters. When they both went off to college, it was like I had to get some stuff tested, and I'm like, I don't know who to talk to or who to call or stuff like that.
Because playtesting is the rough part, because you need people who are willing to just straight up tell you this is garbage and this works. And
well, it's not even that as much. I mean, most people are willing to tell you that. But it's the problem is that I just kind of feel badly, because a lot of times it's like half-assed, it's half-baked. You know, you don't know what's, you know, it's not really ready to go.
Right.
And I have a regular game group that I get together with every other week. But, you know, when they get together, they want to play a game that actually works. You know, I can't come back every single time to my game group and say, okay, here's the next version of this. You know, let's try it again. So, you know, it was really nice to have the kids around where we could just kind of, you know, mess around with stuff. And if we had an idea, I could grab somebody.
They have ownership of it, too.
Right, right. And I can grab them and, you know, we can just grab and sit down and do a 2-player game or a 3-player game, or just pretend to have 4 or 5 people or whatever. So it was good from that standpoint. And it just, from a family standpoint, it's just fantastic to have an activity that we all did together and we could all talk about, even through the teenage years and stuff like that. Gaming in general and designing games in particular was just a nice way to be together. And also, I wanted to give them the perspective of being able to see that an idea that they came up with could, you know, get out on the shelves at Barnes & Noble, and they could trick their friends into there and see what it was, and which they actually were able to do. And they was, you know, it was fantastic, and it was a great experience for them, that this idea that, you know, being creative and having an idea that goes into the marketplace and is finished is not some dream vision that's just like authors off in space or like my heroes or design heroes are just these you know, people out there, but you know, you can do that, and you can take something, and I hope that's something that they carry through with them.
Well, that was like I said when we were talking about the general gaming community, mm-hmm. like when you see these names on these boxes, especially nowadays that they're actually bothering to put the names yes. on the boxes, which they took their sweet time doing. But when you see these names in these boxes, you think, wow, they must be something beyond belief, something, you know, beyond understanding. And then you meet them and you're just like, oh, so they're a regular old human being who gets to do this. And I blew somebody's mind the other day. Like I said, a lot of the people we talk to, they're kind of new to this whole gaming thing. Mm-hmm. And I say, a lot of people don't realize that most designers, not all, but most designers, this is not their only job.
Right.
This is not how most of them make their living. And that just boggles their mind. Like, people think that they're on this whole other plane.
Right. And like my daughter, we were down last year, it was, we were at a convention, and, you know, she was walking by and she saw some people about to play Space Cadets, or Space Cadets Dice Duel, it was, which she had co-designed. She was my co-designer on that. And, you know, so she just like went over and was like, oh, you know, hey, you know, would you like me to teach you how to play? I've played it, because they were learning how to play. I'm like, oh yeah, that would be really nice. And so she taught them, and she also played. They needed another player. You know, and during the explanation, one of the people was like, oh, you're doing such a good job teaching this game. And she's like, well, you know, I did design it, right? And they all kind of laugh, and then they go and they play the whole game. And, you know, and afterwards they're talking about it, and one guy says to her, it's like, boy, you're really good at this game. Really? And she's like, yeah, I designed the game.
I actually did.
And they're like, what? And she like shows, this is me on the box. And they like made her take out ID and show them the I, you know, no, really, here's my driver's license. This is me. That's awesome. You know, so that's, yeah, it's a different kind of a thing.
Well, I definitely want to talk about the new stuff. I mean, I could talk for days. I could talk for days on Dragon and Flagon alone. but I do want to talk about the new ones. I think people would hurt me if I didn't have you talk. I mean, obviously, you can't talk about everything because
I can talk about anything.
Can
let
you?
Me know. Yep, let me
oh
know.
Oh, my goodness. I want to know about The Expanse, because that show is great. And the second I heard, it literally came to the show is great. And then I say, oh, there's going to be an Expanse game. Oh, that's fantastic. And Jeff Engelstein is designing it. Holy cow.
Yeah.
So tell me about what The Expanse is going to look like.
It's, I don't know how much of the story you want me to get into, but I can tell you like
as
the whole genesis of it.
As much as you want to give me.
Okay. So this, it was a little bit different for me. So the very first game that I did, like Ares Project, like I mentioned, was with Z-Man Games, which was owned at that point by Zev Schlesinger. So he has since sold off and left Z-Man Games, and now he's working for WizKids. Mm-hmm. But I've known Zev. He was from New Jersey originally. He was part of this local gaming scene also. Yeah. So he's a WizKids now. So he just called me out of the blue one day and was like, hey, you know, we've got two new licenses and I'd like you to, if you're interested, to design one of them. This was in August. Mm-hmm. Just this past August. And he said, you know, we've got one of them is The Expanse, the TV series, not the books. And the other, it was a movie license, which I can't mention because it's not out yet. And but which I also super love and was super excited about. He says, we need to have it by November. Right. So this is August. So it's about 12 weeks. Right. So it was a very, very, because they said they want to have it out in time while season two is just like wrapping up of The Expanse. So I went back and forth and I thought about it and ended up taking The Expanse I said, I'll do that one. And I wanted to challenge myself to try to do a game in like that 12 to 14 week lead time.
Because that is quite a haul.
And every other game that I've done, I've had an idea. Mm-hmm. I've started with an idea and I've done it. This is the first time it's like, you know, it's more like a school assignment or even more like work. Making air quotes here, you know, somebody comes to you and says, here's a project, you know, it's The Expanse. It's got to cost this much. You know, we want it.
Oh,
for
wow.
The...
They even gave you.
Oh
a
yeah.
Price.
They said no miniatures. We don't want minis in this one. This is a price point. This is the player count. This is the type of player that it is. It's for like a mid-range gamer. It's not it can be a little bit, but it's not like super gamery.
So
game.
They came out with a ton of,
we want it to be. Yeah. And it's got to be done in November. So go. but you know, I wanted to take on that challenge and see if I could do it. And in the end, I was very, very happy with the way that the game came out. So I knew that because of the time frame that I couldn't totally, completely innovate from scratch and come up with something total. You know, I had to kind of build on a platform. So given the nature of the universe, I decided to kind of, I always got sort of a Cold War sort of feeling from it. So I kind of turned to Twilight Struggle as the
which is a good one to turn to.
Right. and kind of built on that, but ended up making it, you know, simplifying it a little bit, but basically making a multiplayer Twilight Struggle where each of the cards was, you know, the events could be used by different factions. There's up to four factions in the game. You're basically trying to get influence on their 16 bases throughout the solar system that you're competing over. So you're trying to get influence around there. So there's these little influence clues that you can put down. And there's also fleets that every player has, each faction has, that they can send around. And the fleets give you bonuses. If you have the most fleets orbiting a planet, then all of the bases on that planet you get a bonus on for your influence. But also you can only normally place influence where you have fleets. So if you want to put influence in a lot of different places, you've got to spread your fleets out. But if you want the bonuses, you want to concentrate them. And then we also added an action track. So there's just all the event cards are face up that you pick from, which I think is easier for newer players. And in Twilight Struggle, you have a hand of cards. Right. So if you want to ask questions about the cards or you're confused about cards, you can't really do it.
You have that awkward moment of, right, what does this do?
Right. So here, there's just all the cards are face up and the players just select from them. But the further down the track you want to pick, you have to sacrifice some victory points.
Okay.
And then every once in a while, scoring cards will come up on the track as well that are shuffled in the deck at certain intervals. And when those come up, you pick them off the track just like a regular card, but instead of taking a normal turn, you do scoring. And at that point, the person who picks a card gets to do a bonus, gets to pick which sector of the board is going to be worth extra points. Everyone gets to an event. There's a few different things that happen, and then you get points based on who's got the most influence. And you do that a couple of times, and then at the end of the game, who's ever got the most points wins. But each faction also has certain technologies, and each time there's a scoring, they get another one of their technologies. So all the factions get more and more powerful and can do more different crazy stuff as the game goes on. A war breaks out at some point, and you can actually start shooting at people easier than you could in the beginning of the game. So it has a nice arc to it, and the whole thing plays in about an hour. So in the end, I was, you know, it was a bit of a struggle to get it to the point where I wanted to, because I tried to be too ambitious in the beginning, which is like all my designs. I tried to throw the kitchen sink in, and then I got to cut back. But in the end, I'm really very, very excited about this game and where it's coming out. And I got to do fun stuff. Like, I got to talk to the authors of the books, and I got to read the scripts before the series was done, so I could see what the plot was going to be and stuff like that. So I had all kinds of fun experiences like that.
So if you got to see the scripts, does that mean that there's going to be stuff that's in the game that might be spoilery for the show?
Well, by the time this game comes out in June, second season of the show will be over. So everything will be out in the game. However, we did have an issue with that, that, you know, even when I read the scripts, I knew that there was this one character in it, which is like this creature, this alien creature that's in it, called the Hybrid. And I had put a Hybrid card into the game. I don't know if you've read the book. I guess you've read the books or seen the series, but it's this really nasty alien creature. And so the effect in the game is that if you take that card, you basically, if you have that event and you decide to do it, you just point to a base and you flip a card over, and the number on the card is the number of influence cubes that blow up. And if it's a scoring card, then everybody just dies. Right. Yeah. So thematically, it was really fun. And, we kept trying, you know, so then we were doing the artwork for the games, and I was getting all the artwork for approval, and they didn't have the right image. It was not an image of the Hybrid on the card. It was some other image that the artist had put on the card. And I kept going back like three times. This is not the right, this is not the Hybrid, this is not the Hybrid.
Right.
And finally, as I got information from WizKids, it said, like, we heard from the production company that they are not giving us an image of the Hybrid because it has not been shown on TV. And even though your game is not coming out until June, this is like a super secret thing. That's what's the Hybrid going to look like is one of our big reveals during the course of the season. So we're not going to give you an image of it.
Well, because it's one thing to read the description of a thing. It's an entirely different thing to actually see it on the screen.
So then right before we're about to go to press, right, I'm watching the show, and the last 5 seconds, the Hybrid walks out onto the show. So I immediately fire off an email to WizKids. I'm like, they just showed the episode with the Hybrid. Can we get the picture now? Please put it in there. We were able to get the picture. So that's the moral of the story.
Well, that said, like, I don't know. I don't think I know of any. Have you ever done, like, licensed work before?
This is my first one.
Is that, like, what kind of other stuff comes into a design when you're dealing with somebody else's license.
Well, it's... Yeah, I mean, it added a lot of interesting factors to it, which is one of the reasons that I wanted to try to take on this challenge, because I hadn't done a licensed game before. And, you know, we tried. I mean, Space Cadets, which for those of you that haven't played that game, it's a cooperative game where the players each play a station on the bridge of a non-infringing starship. Going through the galaxy doing missions.
Legally distinct from Star Trek.
Right. And we really tried to get the Star Trek license for that. I actually talked to companies that had the Star Trek license, and I wanted to call it Starfleet Academy.
Right.
And brand it around that. But in the end, we couldn't do it, so we kind of made up our own setting for it. But so I've always kind of wanted to do that. But it was, you know, I felt a lot of responsibility in a way, because, you know, this is, you know... I love the property. I love the Expanse. So I wanted to do right by it and kind of capture that spirit. But at the same time, I had all these other constraints and stuff like that, that was challenging. And also the writers of the book, when I spoke to the writers, they had a pretty clear idea of what they wanted in the game, which fortunately overlapped with a lot of what I wanted to do.
There you go.
But there were some things, for example, I was looking at like making it more, having like some gating events that kind of moved it along the course of the story. And they said specifically they didn't want it to follow the story of the TV series. They wanted you to like set up the situation in the solar system and the tensions and, you know, have the things that people could do be the things that people could do on the show, but then just let it go and see what happens and not try to maneuver it in that same direction. So,
well, I could buy that, because I know that one of the licenses that has been remade countless times over is the Lord of the Rings,
right?
And at least for my money, the ones that literally follow the Fellowship, I'm like, I know this story. I want to tell a different story.
Yep.
And so it I can see how that would be a thing.
Yeah. So that one, I'm really thrilled for that one to come out. I mean, I love all my games, but I really feel that I can see my design techniques maturing, you know, as you know, I do different games and things like that, and so I feel like that this one hits all the right notes. I'm excited about it.
Well, the other one, and it's fun because I recently said that there are certain games that I see them and I go, I need to play that with a certain person, and even if they're not gamers, I go, no, I need to. Like recently, when Simon announced the Godfather game that's coming out,
I'm yes.
Like, my father would call me on the phone to say it's on TV and we would watch together. Like, so I need to play that with him. The Pit Crew. When I saw the advertisements and stuff for that and the promotional stuff for Pit Crew, I'm like, my mother is a raging NASCAR fan. And the idea of maybe in my wildest dreams getting her to table because it's at least vaguely NASCAR made my day. So I'm curious, because I haven't even had a chance to sit down and deal with actually how it plays and everything. Is it like that frantic, you have seconds to do stuff, or?
It is a real-time game, okay. So it's frantically, yeah. And this was like one of the ones that just came to me as like a fully formed vision or something. I was on Twitter, and somebody on Twitter, Suzanne Sheldon posts on Twitter, and it's like, nobody's ever done a Pit Crew. I love to do a Pit Crew, but she was playing Thunder Alley, which is this NASCAR game. But it really abstracts the pit portion of it. So she was like, somebody should just do a game about a Pit Crew. And I was like, you know,
I can
let me
that.
Take a look at that. I'm on that. And so I've done a number of real-time games. So I mean, Space Cadets has real-time elements, Space Cadets Dice Duel has real-time elements. So you know, I've had a lot of experience with how to design games for real time. And it just seemed like such a natural fit with Pit Crew to have people working. And I also love to have teams of players. I think that's a great social experience of people working together to solve something.
Well, there's been an upswing, at least I've noticed, with games with at least some kind of real-time element to them.
Yeah.
It used to be I'd never see any. Now I've just seen a ton where at least a portion of the game is real-time.
Right. So, you know, and so we decided to do team versus team versus team. So, it's really, really simple. So you can actually, you don't have to be a team. You could do it with each person being one person on a car. So it can take one, two, or three people per car, and there's three cars in the game. So it goes from 2 to 9 people, which is also a nice, really big range.
Yeah.
And basically you have 6 cards divided up amongst a team, and you've got to change 4 tires, and you've got to fill up the fuel tank, and you've got to change the engine. And, you know, when somebody says go, you know, the cards are just numbered from 1 to 10. And so to change a tire, it's real simple. So each tire just has a number on it, different number. So if like a tire is a 4, then on that somebody has to put a 5 or a 3, one higher or one lower. And then on the 5, you got to put a 6 or a 4. Okay. And, you know, you can go up and down as much as you want. And 1 and 10 wrap around to each other. Mm-hmm. And once you have 4 cards on a tire, it's changed. But you don't have to do like one tire and then another tire. You can just play on all the tires or whatever you want at the same time. The fuel tank, there's a number on top of the car, like on the roof, like a NASCAR type car. Like, so if it's like 27, then you can play any numbers you want into the fuel tank, and you're trying to come as close as possible to 27. If you're higher or lower, then the other teams get to move a little bit extra. And then to change the engine, there's different things you have to do depending on the round. You have to play like a pair of same number or two pair or stuff like that. You just play as fast as you can. And then when a team is done with their car, the first team that's done, they can start rolling a die. And every time they roll a 6, they get to move their car up one space on the track. There's like a little racetrack with little cars on it. And then if you're playing with 3 teams, when the second team is done, they can roll their die. And then when the third team is done, they don't get to roll, and everyone has to stop rolling immediately. And then you evaluate the cars. Then when you look at the cars, for every mistake that people make, you can earn things called penalty points. It's like if you messed up on a tire, or if you weren't exactly right on the fuel tank, you add up all the penalty points, and the other cars, the other players' teams get to move forward that number of spaces.
Nice.
But you can also, if you're really good, you can get what's called a turbo bonus. The cards come in 2 different colors, black and white.
Okay.
And if you like do an entire tire of all 4 cards, or all 4 cards are black, or all 4 cards are white, you get to move 2 extra spaces forward.
Okay.
So you could potentially, if you do all 6 elements on the car perfectly, you can move an extra 12 spaces forward, which can be huge. But you're going to have to take more time to do it. You got to spend more time, and you really got to plan, and you know. Right. So you've got to balance. Okay, do we want to be super fast and just get out on the track and start rolling that die, or do we want to take our time? Or where's the balance there? And then in between rounds, each team gets an upgrade card that lets them do something special. And so it's 3 rounds, takes about 10 or 15 minutes. It's teaches fast, it plays fast. You can play with, you know, kids and adults and stuff. So yeah. I think it's a fun little game. But it's frantic. So if you get too pressure, you know, and you freak out under the pressure, then, you know, it may not be the game for you. But it's fast, though. It's not real time for like a half an hour or an hour. You know, it's like little, short little rounds.
When the entire game is like 15 minutes.
Right.
You're not sweating it too much.
Exactly. So it's, you know, and it's fun. And I'll tell you, I've seen people have such fun with that game. You know, I spend all this time, you know, developing these intricate little clockwork type mechanism games sometimes. And this is just like stupid fun. It's based off the old card game Spit, a lot of it. Okay, if you ever played Spit.
Let's say it sounded familiar.
Yeah, it's the one higher, one lower thing. It's just completely stolen from Spit. And yeah, you know, people play it and they do it. And, you know, you talked earlier about getting people together around, you know, making friends around a table. And as I am more involved in gaming and more involved in designing, the more that I am realizing that a really big part of games is that games create a social space for people to interact with each other.
Mm-hmm.
That a game is not about the rules. It's not really about the strategy. You know, it's, yeah, I mean, there's some games and some people that look towards that. And there's some people that like to play solitaire games.
Right.
But basically, you're creating, as a designer, a social space for people to interact with each other. Like in Space Cadets, people want to get on the bridge of the Enterprise and yell, "I need more power, Captain," or, you know, "Where's fire the photon torpedoes," right?
Everybody wants to do that, and then everybody wants to respond with, "I need more dilithium crystals."
Exactly. And, you know, and same thing with Pickers. I wanted to get that team feeling of the anxious spirit and, you know, and things like that. And so I feel that that's, you know, I see that social construct is really, really important with the game design. And I think also to a certain extent, not to stereotype gamers, but I think that playing board games very often will attract people that are less socially apt.
Yeah.
And I think that part of that is, you know, if I put myself into that category, you know, if I walked into a cocktail party and I'm, you know, and I just have to like start walking up to people and talking, you know, that's a challenging thing for me and for a lot of people to do. It's very unstructured, right? There's no rules about what I'm supposed to do and what I'm supposed to talk about and how I get out of that conversation or whatever. You know, if I sit down to play a game, right, I'm sitting down to play Codenames with somebody or Space Cadets or whatever, there's a handbook. You know, here's how you're going to interact with these people, right? This is what you're going to do and how you're going to talk to people. And, you know, there's other stuff that's going to go on outside that, you know, small talk and stuff like that. But basically, you can sit down with a group of people and have more guidance on how you're supposed to interact with them or what you're supposed to do. So I think that that's why it's, you know, that's one of the attractions of it.
Well, one of our kind of like go-to phrases, especially whenever I'm training new leaders, I said, the big thing about games is that it creates that common history. Mm-hmm. Like everybody at that table can tell that story of that one play or that one time that somebody did that one thing. And so I know for me, I've seen people come from different backgrounds, different experiences, even different languages. If you're playing like a dice game, I've seen people, even different languages, sit down and play the same game together.
Yeah.
So,
and that's what I tell my students. I say, one of the questions you need to ask yourself when you're thinking about a game is, what stories do I want the players to tell the next day when they're talking to each other?
Yeah, and the whole experience of just being together, now, regardless of what the game is. Now, granted, the individual stories will differ.
Mm-hmm.
But the overall experience, you're coming away with that moment. And you know, most of the time that we're dealing with stuff, it's within churches or at least church adjacent.
Right.
And one of the things that we always get from church leadership is like, how do I get, you know, the older people to connect with the kids? And how do we get the kind of mentor thing? And I go, if you try to manufacture that, it's not going to work. Like the kids will see right through it and the adults won't care.
Right.
But if you give me the cardboard and you give me the time to play and get them to the same table together.
Yep.
That provides the springboard for all these conversations that lead to that.
Mm-hmm.
Like I got into gaming from somebody 20 years older than me. So it
I think they're absolutely correct. And there is plenty of games that kind of even that playing field also that aren't super luck, you know, don't have to be completely luck based, you know, it's not to be Bunko or something like that. There's plenty of games that have a skill element that because of the skill element that's involved, it levels the playing field between kids and adults, whether it's a little bit of a dexterity element or a memory element or stuff like that, that younger kids can be really good at.
Everybody's good at their thing. Right. So if you throw in a bunch of different things, like, you know, we keep coming back to Space Cadets, depending on which station you are, it's a completely different experience than if you're playing the other kind.
And that was one of the motivations actually behind it was I like playing Robo Rally and my wife Susan hates playing Robo Rally. Yeah. She doesn't like that spatial orientation stuff, right? So, you know, Space Cadets, the helm where you maneuver your ship is basically Robo Rally.
Right.
And so that was a way for me to get to play Robo Rally while she got to do something she wanted to do. So the idea was that people would gravitate towards stuff they liked.
Well, one thing I'm curious about, you've got a bunch of different games and they vary.
Yes.
You know, we're talking about Pit Crew and that's like a light game that you can play with a bunch of people. Fog of War, I haven't gotten it to table. I haven't seen it, but everything I've seen online and on BGG and everything, that is a pretty intense experience. Is there any design that you're itching to do, but you just haven't been able to make it mesh? Like, is there anything that's like sitting in your brain? Like, I want to do this, but I just haven't been able to put the mechanisms together.
I mean, there's been one game that I've been working on for a while and I just haven't been able to get it to work right. And it's weird because, I mean, usually I start with like an experience and then I figure out mechanics to fit that experience. In this case, I started with a mechanic, right? And I'm trying to build it into something. And I think maybe that has something to do with it, but I talked about it on Game Tech on one of my shows once as just an idea of basically taking the concept of quantum entanglement and turning it into a game mechanic.
Wow.
So it's a really funky, simple worker placement type mechanic. So basically, for those of you that aren't familiar with worker placement, you usually have pawns or something called workers, and you can put them on a spaces, you do different things.
Right.
And when you put it on a space, you get to take that action, or sometimes you put all your guys down and you do all the actions. But in this case, to kind of represent this idea of virtual particles that are linked to each other, and virtual particles sometimes may be real and sometimes may not be real.
Yeah.
So the mechanic is that you put two workers down at the same time. Right. And one of them is going to be real and one of them is not, but you don't decide when you put them down. So you either put two workers down or you decide you're going to activate one of your workers, in which case, like if you activate your heart shape worker over here, then that means that this heart shape worker is a fake and comes off the board. But what it can lead to is multiple people can go on the same spaces. And so it leads us like this chain reaction thing. If I activate a worker here, if this one's real, that means my opponent's one that's in the same space has to be fake, which means his other one has to be real, so he gets to do that one, which means that may make somebody else's fake.
Wow.
And it creates this chain reaction, which is really pretty simple once you do it the first time, right? And the idea is that you want to try to activate workers. So you got to choose between activating your own worker to maybe do the best thing that you can do this turn, but at the same time, you maybe give somebody else an action,
right,
which may not be the best for them, but at least they get a free action.
They get a free action.
Right. So that's the mechanic. And I've came up with this quantum theme for it, where you're actually trying to collect quarks and combine the quarks into bigger. It's sort of like a set collection game. And it was close. We played it a lot, but it just wasn't quite there. And so now I've kind of taken that same mechanism. I'm trying to move it into like a time travel sort of a thing, where you're sending workers back into, you know, you're sending agents back in time instead of, you know, workers or what, photons or whatever they were in the quantum mechanic game. They were actually called photons, the workers that you placed.
Right.
So then they'd be like agents going back in time, but maybe this time stream is real and this time stream is fake. And so they kind of go back in both. And it's, I don't know, time travel games are challenging to get the feel right. So I don't know. So that, I keep struggling with that one. I love the mechanic. It's really neat. I'm just trying to find the right way to, the right thing to wrap around it.
Yeah. You're not kidding when time travel is weird. Like, I've seen a couple attempts. The only one that I've seen recently that I would say does it well is a new one that just got, the Kickstarter just came out, was Anachrony.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've heard good things about that. That one has a really interesting time travel.
Where you actually, like, borrow stuff from the future. And then if you don't have it later, bad things happen.
Yeah, you have to give it back, or right, you have to somehow pay for the fact that you didn't give it back.
Like, yes.
That's an interesting mechanic,
yes,
but it does seem complicated.
Yeah, so we'll see. So we'll see if I can get that working.
Well, Jeff, thank you again for doing this. In case somebody doesn't know, what are some ways that they can follow you? And
So the podcast I'm on, the main podcast is Ludology, mm-hmm, and that's at ludology.net, or you can also just, you know, get it on iTunes or Stitcher or any place else that you're getting your podcast. I'm on Twitter. I'm pretty active on Twitter, on at G Engelstein, which is GENGELSTEIN. Mm-hmm. And yeah, if you look me up on Board Game Geek also, I'm around there all the time as well.
Well, again, thank you so much, and I hope you keep making these amazing games that fill my shelves.
Well, thanks for having me. Thanks for putting my kids through college.